united. The sense of purpose, the gravity and determination in the face of evil that has been his trademark since 9/11. And when it comes to a higher moral purpose, I'd like to see the good governor present a case that there's any higher moral cause than defending one's innocent countrymen against terrorist attacks. But Howard Dean doesn't need me to highlight his warped perspective on foreign affairs. He's pretty good at doing it all by himself. During the same New Hampshire speech, he challenged the commander-in-chief and said, "Mr. President, if you'll pardon me, I'll teach you a little about defense." Now, this I'd like to see. What exactly does a five-term governor of Vermont have to teach a masterful wartime president about defense? What experience does Governor Dean bring to the table? Has he been waging a covert military operation against maple syrup smugglers in Vermont? Is he planning to send a contingent of Vermont Special Forces troops on a raid into Canada to acquire prescription drugs? In all seriousness, Governor Dean, whose resume includes time as Lieutenant Governor of Vermont, as a legislator in the Vermont House, as a practicing physician, he ought to think twice before presuming to teach President Bush anything about commanding leadership. Not when our president and his team have already scored decisive victories in its first two battles of global war on terrorism. Howard Dean's reckless tirades against President Bush and his conduct of foreign policy reveal more about Dr. Dean than they do about the president. They tell us that Howard Dean is a complete neophyte when it comes to leadership and world affairs. They tell us that Howard Dean is in no position to lead this nation in the war on terror. But they also reveal Dean's essential arrogance in presuming to lecture the president on a subject that he has no background in and obviously no knowledge about. When we look at the substance of Dean's statements, from his shapeless policy proposals for Iraq to his criticisms of President Bush's leadership, what emerges is that Howard Dean has nothing to offer America but hot air. Dean has also shown a tendency toward the bizarre, as evidenced by his willingness to consider the most fantastic and paranoid conspiracy theories. In December 2003, during an appearance on National Public Radio's Diane Rehm show, Dean implied that the Saudis had given George W. Bush prior notice of the 9/11 attacks. This incredible charge echoes the baseless slander that FDR knew about the Japanese attack on Pearl Harbor but did nothing to stop it. In a conversation about the Kane Commission, the bipartisan panel looking into the circumstances of the 9/11 attacks, Dean implied that Bush was, quote, suppressing evidence that would be useful to the commission. Then he made what is probably the most outlandish comment to come from any serious Democratic candidate this year. Quote, "The most interesting theory that I've heard so far, which is nothing more than a theory, it can't be proved, is that Bush was warned ahead of time by the Saudis." Dean left the comment hanging just as it was, without further elaboration. Given a chance later to backtrack on Fox News Sunday, Dean simply pleaded ignorance to host Chris Wallace about the theory's truth. Quote, "I can't imagine the president of the United States doing that, but we don't know, and it'd be a nice thing to know." Republicans are not the only ones appalled by Dean's comments. As conservative columnist Robert Novak reports, one Democratic political veteran told him that, quote, "Dean doesn't understand that he's accusing Bush of something worse than an impeachable offense. It's treason." Yet Howard Dean seemed intrigued by the theory that George Bush might be a traitor with the blood of 3,000 of his fellow citizens on his hands. Why? Because he thinks raising the idea might win him some votes among the conspiracy nut crowd. Or far worse, maybe he actually believes it. Howard Dean may be his party's frontrunner, and he may be a passionate liberal, but in his campaign for the Democratic nomination, he has also demonstrated that he lacks the temperament and maturity of judgment, at the very least, to be the next president of the United States. We all know by now, of course, that John Kerry served with distinction in the United States Navy during the Vietnam War, and I've said on my radio and television shows numerous times, we are all indebted to all our servicemen and servicewomen for their sacrifices. And I'm the first to thank all our military personnel, past and present, for their service to America. However, I don't believe that simple military service renders anyone immune from criticism when it comes to foreign policy, and especially to as critical a challenge as the war on terror. Indeed, it would be irresponsible to permit a veteran's reckless comments on foreign policy and military affairs to go unchecked merely because of his status as a veteran. It would do a disservice to the very causes to which he contributed. John Kerry of Massachusetts has served as the state's lieutenant governor and is currently a member of the U.S. Senate. Throughout his career, Senator Kerry has shown himself to be a political animal of the first order. His policies have shifted time and time again with the prevailing winds, especially we know now when it comes to running for president. Having begun his political career as an anti-Vietnam liberal, he is now attempting to remake himself into a moderate, and he is anything but. And in passing himself off as something he is not, in his constant shifting, waffling, and flip-flopping on the tough questions of the day, Kerry has shown himself to be guided not by a strong moral compass, but by the shifting sands of pure political opportunism. Take, for example, his position on the use of military force in Iraq. Along with 76 of his Democratic colleagues, Senator Kerry voted on October 22, 2002, to authorize President Bush to use military force in Iraq. At the time of the vote, Kerry explained why he would be supporting the president. He said, "Let me be clear. The vote I will give to the president is for one reason and one reason only, to disarm Iraq of weapons of mass destruction if we cannot accomplish that objective through new tough weapons inspections in joint conference with our allies." In April of 2003, as his party's old appetite for anti-war candidates was beginning to rear its head, Senator Kerry seemed to change his tune. Now claimed that he'd voted to authorize the use of force to, quote, give the president a legitimate threat of force to go to the United Nations and form a coalition. And then on August the 31st of 2003, Kerry claimed that he had voted to protect the security of the country in a way that defended America's values and defended the troops. And then on September 3rd, Kerry said that the president didn't need our authorization in the first place. So which is it, Senator Kerry? Did you or did you not cast your vote for one reason and one reason only? And if so, what was the reason? To disarm Iraq of weapons of mass destruction? To give the president a legitimate threat of force? To protect the security of the country? Or was his vote unnecessary altogether? The reason John Kerry has such different reasons for his vote is that he doesn't want to tell the truth. The truth is that he remembered that the politicians who voted against the first Gulf War had paid a political price for voting against the use of force. John Kerry, after all, was one of them. And with his own presidential chances hanging in the balance, he didn't want to be caught on the wrong side of history a second time. But Kerry bet on the wrong horse. The truth is, his vote in favor of the war ended up hurting him more than an anti-war vote ever would have. Among the fervent anti-Bush, anti-war base, he would have needed to win his party's nomination. You see, anyone who wants to gain the Democratic presidential nomination has got to win the allegiance of the party's hardcore left. These are the people who make signs comparing Bush to Hitler, who build effigies of our president and then tear them down as if they were Iraqi citizens tearing down statues of Saddam Hussein. For such strident ideologues, a yay vote on any type of war is a mark against the candidate. Kerry's naked attempt to have it both ways has dogged his campaign ever since. That's why, 1 year later, Kerry chose to vote against the president's request for the funding required to finance the war and help rebuild Iraq. "I voted against the $87 billion in Washington yesterday," he proclaimed, "but let me make it clear, I'm for winning the war in Iraq." Can you believe this? How does the senator expect the military to finish the job in Iraq without the necessary funding? Would Senator Kerry deny our men and women in combat the necessary funds for waging war? Even Democratic onlookers were astonished by the vote. It doesn't take a Republican to recognize that Kerry is trying to cast himself as both a hawk and a dove. Sometimes Kerry's hypocrisy is so flagrant that it's hard to imagine what he was thinking. After roundly denouncing President Bush for his appearance on the USS Abraham Lincoln to welcome home troops from the Middle East, Kerry formally announced his presidential candidacy standing in front of an aircraft carrier in South Carolina. Sometimes his stridency brings into question his presidential timbre. In a campaign appearance in New Hampshire, Kerry told the crowd, "What we need now is not just a regime change in Saddam Hussein in Iraq. We need a regime change in the United States." Now, when I first heard that line, I couldn't believe my ears. Kerry was speaking on April 2nd, day 14 of Operation Iraqi Freedom. So while our troops were fighting and dying to liberate Iraq and safeguard the security of the United States, there was Senator Kerry, the would-be commander-in-chief of the United States, undermining the actual commander-in-chief with a soundbite that was both tasteless and disturbing. When it comes to campaigning, John Kerry might have done better to take his own advice. with his blatant inconsistencies and persistent pandering, it is he who has alienated longtime friends and allies, his friends in the Democratic Party, the ones he was expecting to vote him into the presidency. In marked contrast to John Kerry, Richard Gephardt came to Washington in 1977 as a moderate to conservative Democrat. He was against abortion, against school busing, and supported school prayer. In a news release from August of 1981, Congressman Gephardt criticized President Reagan for not taking more action to promote those issues. The young Congressman Gephardt has been described as an unabashed abortion critic and social conservative looking for openings to persuade others. He voted early in his career against extending the deadline to ratify the Equal Rights Amendment to the Constitution for his prohibitions on government-backed legal assistance in gay rights cases. In defense and foreign policy matters, Gephardt was equally moderate. By the time he went to Congress in 1977, the St. Louis Post-Dispatch reports, Gephardt's views on defense mirrored his centrist positions on taxes, abortions, and other matters. He favored the development of the neutron bomb, the resumption of the production of nerve gas, and the reinstatement of the draft. In 1981 and 1982, he voted against efforts to curb funding for the B-1 bomber, chemical weapons, and the MX missile. How then did the moderate young Gephardt transform himself into a liberal icon? Well, the answer is simple politics. As the Washington Post puts it, Gephardt was elected to Congress as an anti-abortion moderate in 1976. He moved to the left later in his career, running for president in 1988 as a liberal aligned with labor. In other words, he did what he had to do to advance his career in the Democratic Party. He followed the party on its steady path toward liberalism. Gephardt was eager to ascend to a leadership position in the House of Representatives, but when he recognized that his previous positions on both domestic and foreign policy would have disqualified him, he veered leftward. In 1986, when Gephardt was planning his first presidential campaign, he abandoned his anti-abortion position. Quote, on any issue of conscience, he has said, every American must travel their own personal journey and reach their own certainty. At the beginning of my journey in public service, I didn't yet realize the full consequences of my beliefs. It's not unheard of for a politician to flip-flop on mundane issues such as taxes or even Social Security. But abortion is a different matter altogether. It involves life and death. I don't claim to know what's in Richard Gephardt's heart, but many observers suspect that his decision to change his stand on abortion was a purely political calculation, another step to the left designed to further his rise in the Democratic leadership. Representative Gephardt's record on foreign policy is just as troublesome. In 1987, Gephardt denounced President Reagan as pursuing a rogue foreign policy. As UPI reported at the time, Gephardt said the Reagan administration will be remembered for its efforts to prepare for nuclear war and said the administration's recent movement toward an arms control agreement with the Soviet Union is merely the last refuge of a presidency that has run out of other ideas. As we've seen, history has judged Ronald Reagan to be one of the most visionary presidents of the 20th century. The chess match he played and won with Mikhail Gorbachev was a lesson in the importance of staring down evil. In 1991, Gephardt voted against authorizing the first President Bush to use force in the Persian Gulf War. Indeed, he reportedly spearheaded the opposition in the House over the war. By the following year, Gephardt must have realized the mistake he had made, though he had run for the Democratic nomination in 1988, even winning the Iowa caucuses, he opted not to challenge President George Herbert Walker Bush in the 1992 race. But Gephardt would not make the same mistake twice. In 2002, he appeared with President George W. Bush in a Rose Garden ceremony to express his support of a second Gulf War. During the primaries, Gephardt was generally supportive of the use of force in Iraq. There are indications, however, that Gephardt, at the same time he appears to support the president, is trying to increase his appeal with the anti-war left. Gephardt has begun to use the phrase root causes when discussing the war on terror. Root causes is a term loaded with meaning for liberals, most often used in the criminal justice debate. Liberals believe that if you just remove the root causes of crime, such as poverty or absentee parents or drug abuse, then you can end crime. We conservatives, on the other hand, believe that crime is a choice made with free will, that some individuals choose to be evil, regardless of whether they're rich or poor. And furthermore, just as labeling Hitler or Saddam as a madman is a dangerous distraction from the reality of their evil behavior, We contend that searching out root causes for a crime merely serves to provide the criminal an excuse for his behavior. And yet there was Dick Gephardt, during one of the Democratic debates, treating the problem of terrorism as if he were Lyndon Johnson fighting the war on poverty all over again. Quote, I think the administration has failed in getting at the root causes of terrorism. I think they're just dealing with the symptoms of terrorism, and I support those efforts. You've got to stop someone from doing harm to the United States if they are bound and determined to do it, but we've got to get to all the root causes. He goes on, let me say this. If we are to defeat terrorism, we've got to engage in countries across the world. We've got to fight against poverty. We've got to fight against bad governance. And we've got to say to people that are supporting terrorists, this behavior cannot stand. Well, that kind of talk may endear Dick Gephardt to the far left, but it won't do him much good in the real world, where terrorists are committed to our death and destruction. What his remarks do reveal, though, is that Gephardt's approach to the war on terror would involve funneling money to the Middle Eastern nations that hate us, trying to reform their governments while asking them to stop supporting terrorism. Well, maybe Gephardt hasn't caught on. Osama bin Laden is already a multimillionaire. So how would an international war on poverty have stopped him? And what's in it for Syria or Iran or any other Arab dictatorship that doesn't want to reform its people and stop harboring terrorists? Like Jimmy Carter getting his olive branch snapped in two by the Ayatollah, like Bill Clinton being played for a fool by Kim Jong-il, Dick Gephardt is still convinced that sweet talk and a lot of American cash can stop a terrorist regime in its tracks. America has seen too much failed Democratic presidential policy in the last quarter century to let that happen again. Congressman Gephardt is no less a political animal than Senator Kerry. He's been in Washington for close to 30 years, and it shows. Now, Gephardt may have arrived in Washington full of conviction, but slowly and inexorably, his principles were sacrificed to his political aspirations. In the latest bid for the Democratic presidential nomination, he tried to position himself as the anti-Dean, making a political calculation to support the war in Iraq. But in the process, he only alienated the hardcore left that has made Dean the frontrunner for the nomination. In the end, what does this record of pandering and posturing tell us about Dick Gephardt? Well, the same thing it tells us about John Kerry, his colleague on Capitol Hill. It's one thing to be a politician. It's a different thing entirely to be a leader. Now, personally, I like Senator Joe Lieberman of Connecticut. I do believe he has a strong moral compass and strong convictions. He has consistently supported President Bush in the war on terror, and there are many issues where we find common ground. But I don't believe he's the right man for the presidency. Why? Because like most of the other Democratic presidential hopefuls, Lieberman believes that only the internationalization of our foreign policies can make those policies legitimate. Like his colleagues, he has conveyed repeatedly that his top priority is to form broad international coalitions with nations such as France and Germany to help implement his policies, leaving open the implication that he, like other Democrats, would be reluctant to act without those nations' support. Concerning American forces in Iraq, Senator Lieberman said, "It would be great to get Iraqis to be fighting by our side. We ought to have NATO with us." But how would bringing NATO into Iraq improve the situation there? The North Atlantic Treaty Organization was organized during the Cold War to protect Western Europe from the USSR. Though NATO's role has evolved since the disintegration of the Soviet Union, there's still nothing to suggest that its presence in Iraq would make a qualitative difference in our efforts to help rebuild that nation and suppress further terrorist insurrections. To solicit the help of other individual nations in furthering the war on terror is one thing. President Bush has done that. When some nations like France and Germany have failed to step forward, he has proceeded without them. But to predicate the defense of our national security on the involvement of international institutions like NATO or the United Nations is to enter into dangerous territory. When it comes to the United Nations especially, Senator Lieberman's faith in such a corrupt and ineffective body is entirely misplaced. In this faith, he's not alone among the Democrats. Richard Gephardt, John Kerry, Howard Dean, Wesley Clark are all on record saying either that the U.S. should not have initiated military action against Iraq without the U.N. and that we should seek U.N. support in post-war Iraq. And yet, as we've seen, the United Nations as a body is demonstrably corrupt, peopled heavily by inhuman dictators who cannot be trusted for a moment to act in defense of a greater good or even the good of their own people. This is the organization whose Human Rights Commission chair, a Libyan official, opened a recent conference by declaring that a war in Iraq, quote, would destroy everything and will certainly violate all human rights and especially the right to life. So as a blind allegiance to the UN, what we could expect of a Lieberman presidency, of a President Dean or Gephardt or Kerry or Clark? In 4 years, would Iraq be overrun by human rights advisors from Libya? Here's the fundamental difference I have with Joe Lieberman and his Democratic cohorts on the war on terror. I do not believe the United States should ever surrender its authority over foreign affairs and especially over matters of our national security to any international body, and certainly not to this one. If other nations are willing to support our mission, then by all means we should accept their support, but not at the price of forfeiting our leadership. Anyone who looks to the United Nations as a cure-all for our challenges in fighting terror, or indeed as a source of legitimacy in any question of foreign affairs, is gravely mistaken. If Senator Lieberman were elected president, his stated position that he would insist on UN approval before engaging our forces abroad would cause certain harm to our national interests. No matter how much the United States works with the United Nations, no American president must ever place the interests of that body or any other nation above those of the United States of America. President Bush has put his entire presidency on the line in the war on terror. He has been willing to take his own political risks in order to ensure our safety. Joe Lieberman has not proven that he's willing to do the same. General Wesley Clark was one of the last individuals to enter the race for the Democratic nomination for president. A career soldier who served as NATO's Supreme Allied Commander, Commander-in-Chief of the U.S. Southern Command, and Director for Strategic Plans and Policy for the Joint Chiefs of Staff, Clark, like Kerry, is to be commended for his service to his country. Yet in the week since he declared himself a candidate, compelling evidence emerged that General Clark was an utter failure in these high positions of responsibility. A review of these charges leaves little doubt that this man is not fit to lead his country at war or at home. In June of 1999, while serving as Supreme Allied Commander of NATO, Wesley Clark risked confrontation with the Russians when he authorized the use of Apache attack helicopters to block the Pristina airport in Kosovo from Russian troops. The British general under Clark refused that order, and eventually the confrontation was resolved through diplomatic means. Standing up to the Russians when justified, necessary, and prudent, of course, doesn't bother me at all. But Clark's behavior in this incident seems reckless to me. Why risk igniting a broader confrontation? At that point in the Kosovo War, the NATO bombing had ended. Peace was largely restored. What would possess Clark to take such aggressive action to risk starting another conflict? Clark has also been a firsthand witness to the tragic ineffectiveness of the United Nations to halt one of the most brutal instances of genocide in modern history. In the summer of 1994, as hundreds of thousands of Rwandans were being massacred, the UN peacekeeping force responsible for monitoring the country's reconstituted government failed utterly to stop the murders. Romeo Dallaire, commander of the 2,600-soldier peacekeeping force, sent frantic requests for reinforcements to help stop the bloodbath, but his pleas were rejected. Not one country on earth came to stop this thing, Dallaire said. The Western world provided me with nothing. At the time, Wesley Clark had been assigned to work with the UN to help alleviate the situation. In an interview with Dan Rather, he describes their talks. Quote, "But Dan, I had been in the Pentagon during the summer of 1994 when 800,000 people were hacked to death by machetes in Rwanda. I was the officer responsible for doing plans and contingencies for the United Nations, and I did a number of those with my staff, and we presented them, and we talked about them, and, you know, we stroked our chins, and we worried about things, and we thought, you know, is this going to be acceptable?" The next time a Democratic presidential candidate like Wesley Clark demands that the UN be brought in to rebuild Iraq, remember how that body reacted to American proposals to intervene. We presented them and we talked about them and, you know, we stroked our chins. That is how the United Nations chose to act while nearly a million Rwandans were being slaughtered on their watch. Wesley Clark ought to be ashamed of himself for investing them with any faith whatsoever. Perhaps the most telling evidence of General Clark's unfitness to lead, however, is the low opinion in which he is held by his fellow generals. It's a matter of record that Clark was relieved of his duty in Europe prematurely, asked to retire by Joint Chiefs of Staff Hugh Shelton. In September 2003, Shelton was asked whether he would support Clark as a presidential candidate. He answered, "I've known West for a long time, and I will tell you the reason he came out of Europe early had to do with integrity and character issues, things that are near and dear to my heart. I'm not going to say whether I'm a Republican or a Democrat. I'll just say West won't get my vote." It gets worse. According to an in-depth profile that appeared in The New Yorker in November 2003, Clark was even distrusted by William Cohn, Bill Clinton's Secretary of Defense, under whom he served. In 1997, the post of Commander-in-Chief of United States Forces in Europe became open. This command included the forces of NATO. Clark was not the Army's nominee for the post, and the Army Chief of Staff, General Dennis Reimer, refused to recommend him. But other non-military voices advocated on his behalf, and eventually Secretary Cohn offered him the job. Within 2 short years, though, Cohn was regretting his decision. Cohn, according to someone who worked closely with him, had come to regard Clark's hiring as one of the worst mistakes of his tenure at defense, and the relationship between the two men became so strained that one of the Joint Chiefs still groans at the memory of Cohn's tortured body language when Clark would enter the room. What so vexed Cohn and the Chiefs was not just the fact that Clark had routinely gone behind their backs or that Clark was so unyieldingly certain of his judgment. They believed that, too often, Clark's judgment was wrong. In the run for the White House, Wesley Clark's greatest calling card is his military background. Indeed, the Democrats seemed so overjoyed by the prospect of having a genuine wartime leader for their party that they seemed to have overlooked one thing. Some of America's finest generals believed him to be ambitious, inflexible, backstabbing, and lacking military acumen, judgment, and integrity. This is not the kind of leader America needs at this time or any time. With the capture of Saddam Hussein, the battle in Iraq is largely over. Though we are still engaged in the war on terror, no immediate confrontation looms on the horizon. Instead, public interest will soon shift more directly to the choice of candidates in the 2004 presidential election. As citizens, we have the opportunity to reaffirm our support of a president who has shown the courage to stand alone in defense of our liberties. The Democratic Party will eventually select one figure among many: Howard Dean, John Kerry, Richard Gephardt, Joe Lieberman, or Wesley Clark to oppose him. But that candidate, whoever he is, will represent ideas that would actively threaten America's security in this time of continuing despotism and terror around the world. Howard Dean has demonstrated that he does not possess the requisite foreign policy experience to lead our nation. His liberal policies of appeasement would harm America. He has stated proudly that he would not have protected America by invading Iraq, that instead he would have conditioned any such military action on UN approval. In some respects, a Dean presidency might set America back even further than the feckless Clinton era, back to the wholehearted appeasement of Jimmy Carter. Both John Kerry and Richard Gephardt have proven that they lack the strong moral compass that is required to lead our country. Kerry has been inconsistent throughout the debate over war in Iraq, Gephardt throughout his entire political history. Both are products of the Washington establishment. Both have proven willing to take whatever political position appears politically advantageous at any given time. And by now, I think it's clear that the American people would prefer another kind of leader, one who knows his own mind. Wesley Clark is dangerous for the decisions that he failed to make in the past, standing by while the UN failed to stop the genocide in Rwanda, and for the decisions he would make in the future, including ceding control of Iraq to the United Nations. If his fellow generals aren't willing to support him, I see no reason for us voters to do so. Joe Lieberman is the least appalling of the bunch, yet even he seems to place his faith in the creation of international coalitions, coalitions that would jeopardize American security interests. When Joe Lieberman and his Democratic colleagues talk of using the highly questionable United Nations to aid our efforts throughout the world, I wonder whether they can possibly understand what they're recommending and the danger it would spell for our country. When we go to the polls this November, we are weighing in the balance the course of America in these early years of the 21st century. Whether it will be guided and protected by a strong and courageous leadership or become mired in policies of appeasement. As George Washington warned, America must not become over-dependent on entangling alliances with international bodies, national or institutional, whose interests are not our own. As my audiences know, I'm no blind supporter of President George W. Bush. I have often criticized his domestic policies, and I don't believe he's perfect. But as we enter this election year, I do believe he is the right man in the right place at the right time in human history. His qualities echo the best that America has to offer: strength, courage, conviction, and the ability to know right from wrong and a determination to choose the right path. For the sake of our nation and the world, I hope we as a nation will continue down that path along with him. The war on terror, as we have seen, has forced America in some ways to reinvent itself, to reassess ideas like defense and homeland security, to rewrite the rules of war, to recognize new kinds of enemies and prepare to confront them. In this recording, I've tried to reawaken our appreciation of the lessons of our past to help us apply them to the challenges of the future. Perhaps the most important of these concerns the sheer persistence of evil. Now, whether it takes the fiendishly organized form of Nazism, communism, or other forms of despotism, or erupts around the world in the loose networks we call terrorism, one thing is clear: evil will thrive unless it is confronted and it is defeated. We'd be foolish to assume that there's any quick fix, any single solution to the challenges America will face in the continuing battle with our terrorist foes. But keep in mind that the Cold War was a marathon as well, lasting some 50 years. From that experience, we learn that with strong moral conviction, steadfast confidence in the rightness of liberty and democracy, and resolute leadership, freedom can overcome tyranny and terror. Just as we look back to learn from our forebears, we must look forward to the potential threats in our future and look outward to the regions where trouble may already be brewing. The world is filled with such hot spots, most of which will require our focused attention at some point in the next 5, 10, even 20 years. From the Persian Gulf to the Far East, from unfamiliar lands like Syria to the targets of terror in our own homeland, the United States can expect once again to confront evil. If we succeed, and I'm confident we will, Americans will be safer and freer, but so too will the oppressed peoples of the world. Our success will be measured in many different ways. With luck, the necessity of armed conflict will diminish through the years as fewer bad actors step forward to challenge us and the rewards of democracy become apparent in new parts of the globe. With luck, we can minimize nuclear proliferation, eliminate nuclear conflict, and erase the shadow of terrorism from the lives of our children. But our quest to eradicate tyranny or terror will not succeed through weakness. In the coming years, we will periodically face internal opposition from those in our country who lack the vision and fortitude to oppose evil. For years into the future, Americans will engage in a debate on whether we should appease evil, as we did in the 1930s, 1970s, and 1990s, or meet it squarely. Today, the choice we face is between a Democratic Party that sees American power as a source of arrogance and violence, and leaders like George W. Bush, who see American power as a force for peace and security. In closing, then, let us look briefly outward to those hot spots where evil may one day challenge us again. The People's Republic of China may not be at the center of American radar screens in these days of turmoil in the Persian Gulf and rising Islamic terror around the world. In the last decade, however, it has become an increasingly stronger and more threatening power in its region. A recent Defense Department report cited China's ambitions to dominate Asia, compel Taiwan to reunify with the mainland, and prevent the United States from interfering with either objective. As such, China constitutes a threat to three of our close allies in the region: Taiwan, Japan, and South Korea. In each case, the United States is obliged by agreement to come to the defense of these free nations. In view of these commitments, China's apparent determination to amass as much military-related technology as it can as quickly as possible is troubling indeed. China, of course, is the only remaining large communist state on the face of the earth, as well as the largest totalitarian regime. One recurring source of crisis on the Chinese front has been its highly charged relationship with its smaller democratic neighbor, Taiwan. In the last 50 years, while China has stagnated under communism, Taiwan has progressed slowly but surely toward democracy. In 2000, Taiwan underwent its first peaceful transition of power from the Nationalist Party to the Democratic Progressive Party. Eventually, there's every reason to believe China will take military action to attempt to reunite Taiwan with mainland China. And on this subject, China has done more than talk. It has built a full-scale model of a major Taiwanese airfield and used it to practice assaults and has conducted a ballistic missile blockade of Taiwan. Why is this all of immediate concern to America? Because today, for the first time, Taiwan is beginning to assert its independence, and because the Taiwan Relations Act of 1979, in the words of one account, holds that any threat to the peace and security of Taiwan is of grave concern to the United States. The act explicitly states that the United States is obliged to make available to Taiwan such defense articles and defense services in such quantity as may be necessary to enable Taiwan to maintain a sufficient defense capability. In other words, the U.S. is committed to take action to defend Taiwan from any Chinese aggression. But our own concern with China should go beyond the issue of Taiwan. China, according to President Jiang Zemin, in 1995, views the West, including the United States, as its chief enemy. As authors Edward Timberlake and William C. Triplett II have observed, the United States is the main obstacle to China's ambition to dominate Asia. As Timberlake and Triplett have documented, the Chinese is targeting the American people with nuclear weapons and is developing entirely new generations of land, sea, and space-based strategic weapon systems capable of threatening any location on the planet. At times, China has talked tough concerning nuclear weapons. In 1999, the Chinese Office of the Central Military Command issued a report alluding to a possible nuclear confrontation with the United States over Taiwan. From its territorial claims on Taiwan to its buildup of nuclear, conventional, and information warfare capabilities to its stated aim to dominate its region and take the West as its enemy, China should already be a major source of concern to the United States as well as the neighboring democracies it has threatened. With the defeat of Saddam Hussein in Iraq, Iran is poised to become the dominant power in the Middle East. It has a huge population, some 65 million people, along with a relatively strong military and vast oil reserves. Iran's brutal theocracy is hostile to the policies of liberty and freedom and poses an enormous threat to stability in a critical region of the world. Iran is a primary supporter of terrorism and is actively pursuing the acquisition and development of nuclear weapons it could use to threaten Israel and other American interests. Iran is one of three nations President Bush named as the axis of evil. It is ruled by a group of Islamic fundamentalists with a deplorable human rights record. According to the State Department reports, Iran's human rights violations include summary executions, disappearances, widespread use of torture, and other degrading treatment, reportedly including rape, severe punishments such as stoning and flogging, harsh prison conditions, arbitrary arrest, and detention. And not surprisingly, Iran's regime significantly restricts citizens' rights to change their government. In the year 2001, the State Department reports Iran remained the most active state sponsor of terrorism, having long provided Lebanese Hezbollah and the Palestinian projectionist groups, notably Hamas, the Palestinian Islamic Jihad, with varying amounts of funding, safe haven, training, and weapons. It is critical for the well-being and safety of all Americans that Iran be prevented from further supporting these terrorist entities. Just as disturbing as its support for terrorism, however, is Iran's development of nuclear weapons. As Amir Tahiri has written in National Review Online, Iran has a nuclear program designed to make such weapons within 18 months. It is like a chef who brings in all that is needed for making a soup, but does not actually start the cooking until he knows when the guests will be coming. Mr. Tahiri quotes from Iranian President Rafsanjani, quote, "In a nuclear duel in the region, Israel may kill 100 million Muslims. Muslims can sustain such casualties knowing that in exchange there would be no Israel on the map." There is little question that the ruling mullahs in Iran will continue to support international terrorism, but it now appears that the Iranians are close to finally acquiring nuclear weapons. With such capability, they could easily attempt to blackmail the United States by making a credible threat to destroy Israel, our primary ally in the region. For the sake of that nation and our own, we must be stalwart in confronting any threat of aggression from the state of Iran. Syria is critical because of its strategically important location in the Middle East. With Iraq to its east and south, Turkey to the north, Lebanon and Israel to the west and Jordan to its south, Syria is in a position to exert influence for good or evil over the entire region. But Syria is a problematic nation with past and continuing affiliations with terrorist organizations like Al-Qaeda and despotic nations like Iraq. As the Los Angeles Times has reported, quote, Syria has functioned as a hub for an Al-Qaeda network that moved Islamic extremists and funds from Italy to northeastern Iraq, where the recruits fought alongside recently defeated Ansar al-Islam terrorist group. Moreover, Syria has provided refuge to a range of extremists, Palestinians, Turks, Lebanese, even former Nazis, and a renegade U.S. intelligence agent, and denied doing so. According to some experts, Syria now ranks as the worst Arab country in terms of its ambitions to develop weapons of mass destruction, support for terrorism, and human rights abuses. John Bolton, Undersecretary of State for Arms Control, has stressed that Syria poses in both its WMD plans and its support for terrorism. During his rule, according to Bolton, Saddam Hussein used the Syrian conduit, among others, to assure the flow of dual-use equipment for his WMD programs and rearm his military. The Bush administration suspects that Syria is continuing to develop an offensive biological weapons capability, has stockpiled chemical weapons such as sarin and VX nerve gas, and has equipped part of its force of several hundred ballistic missiles with chemical warheads. Even after the defeat of Saddam Hussein, Syria will remain a threat as long as Syria is free to fund terrorist activities in the Middle East and perhaps elsewhere. Terrorists will continue to wage war against us. The day may well come when action must be taken to rid the volatile Middle East of this repressive and aggressive Syrian regime. The nation of communist North Korea might be described more accurately as the world's largest prison camp, a hyper-militarized dictatorship where one man, the notorious Kim Jong-il, holds absolute power. Kim has turned North Korea into an economic basket case that is barely able to feed its own citizens. Its enormous and aggressive military can only be supported through the sale of missiles and missile technology and the trafficking of illegal drugs and counterfeit money. It is a country that is completely unrestrained by the code of conduct of the civilized world. In a development almost too horrible to contemplate, this evil regime is also believed to have recently developed nuclear weapons. To make matters worse, according to the Los Angeles Times, U.S. intelligence officials believe North Korea has an untested ballistic missile capable of reaching the western U.S. Given its history of supplying weapons to rogue states like Libya and Syria, North Korea has earned its ignoble place in the axis of evil. Its instability, its economic duress, its egomaniacal dictator, and its nuclear capabilities all conspire to make it a continuing threat to the United States and the world at large. North Korea's People's Army is one of the world's largest, with 1.17 million troops. The United States, by comparison, only has 1.4 million troops spread all over the globe. Over the past few decades, North Korea's troops have been moved closer to the American and South Korean forces along the demilitarized zone, the DMZ. Of the 1 million troops in the army, according to one account, about 700,000 are stationed within 62 miles of the DMZ. And in addition, North Korea has more than 6 million reservists. North Korea has also 100,000 troops in its special ops forces, which makes it the largest special forces element in the world. And the North Koreans have no compunction about using these forces. Since the Korean War, the North has repeatedly gone on the attack, kidnapping Japanese and South Korean citizens, digging tunnels through the bedrock below the DMZ in South Korea, tunnels big enough for an invasion force to pass through at a rate of 10 soldiers a minute, sending an assassination team to Seoul to kill the president, bludgeoning to death with axes two American officers in the joint security area of the DMZ, blowing up and killing seven senior members of a South Korean delegation to Burma, four cabinet members, two presidential advisors, and an ambassador, initiating countless naval battles with southern ships, resulting in numerous fatalities, sending a submarine to land commandos in the south, launching a missile over Japan, and the list goes on. North Korea's economy has been described as close to a meltdown. Millions are suffering from acute shortages of food caused by industrial collapse. North Korea suffered massive starvation in the 1990s after the Soviet Union, its ally and source of support, ceased to exist. As many as 2 million North Koreans are thought to have died from starvation since the mid-1990s, and 42% of children are chronically malnourished. North Korea has been building its own Scud missiles since the 1980s. The Taipodong-1, a super missile based on Scud technology, was test-fired over Japan in 1998, shocking the world. There are now indications that North Korea has developed the Taipodong-2 with a range of nearly 5,000 miles, which could reach the western United States. The North Koreans have also made modifications to Scuds to enable them to carry chemical and bacteriological warheads. It is estimated that North Korea has 500 Scud missiles of various types, and these programs have been a source of cash as well as firepower for Kim's isolated nation. Since the 1980s, North Korea has raised cash by exporting missiles or missile technology to Yemen, Iran, Libya, Syria, Pakistan, and Egypt. The United States has already fought one war against North Korea at great expense in American lives and resources. If we are to avoid another such confrontation, America may have to arm its allies in the region, including Japan, with nuclear weaponry significant enough to keep North Korea contained long enough for its government to collapse altogether. This, in turn, will require us to abandon the misguided Carter-Clinton practice of bilateral U.S.-North Korean negotiations and phony deals in which we support Kim's regime in exchange for false promises to stop its nuclear program. Instead, a coalition of South Korea, Japan, Taiwan, and even China and Russia might be assembled to exert pressure on North Korea. Ironically, though, this is one place where multilateralism may be invaluable. Democrats don't seem to agree. In any event, the burgeoning military strength combined with domestic instability of North Korea poses a sobering threat to American security and interests, and our government must respond by increasing our military capabilities to meet that challenge. Despite significant recent increases in military spending, American forces are spread thin thanks to the budget slashing of the 1990s. If we fail to restore our defensive strength, it will be at our own risk. Now let's consider Al-Qaeda. Before September 2001, few Americans were aware of this shadowy terrorist group. But long before Al-Qaeda made its direct attack on U.S. soil, it already had a history of attacking America, her people, and her interests overseas. Osama bin Laden himself declared in a notorious 1998 statement that it was the duty of all Muslims to kill American citizens, military or civilian, along with our allies around the world. Like the Japanese in World War II, however, Al-Qaeda has learned the consequences of awakening the sleeping giant. The United States has already killed or captured many key members of Al-Qaeda's leadership. Osama bin Laden is either dead or on the run, and Al-Qaeda's ability to carry out new attacks has been seriously undercut. Still, we have not seen an end of Al-Qaeda. It continues to recruit new members and execute its deadly plans around the world. And it's the nature of this diffuse and clandestine group to operate at skeletal strength. After all, it only took a handful of terrorists on 9/11 to unleash the hell that killed so many of our countrymen. Larry Medford is the FBI's Executive Assistant Director of Counterterrorism and Counterintelligence. In his estimation, Al-Qaeda's power has diminished but is still potent. While we think they are clearly downgraded and their abilities are not what they used to be, they are still a very, very serious threat. And the reason they are a serious threat is they are absolutely focused and committed to attacking America. Medford made this statement in an interview in November of 2003. Recent headlines continue to track Al-Qaeda and its operations around the world. Evidence has suggested that Al-Qaeda operatives planned the suicide bombings in Istanbul, Turkey. An Al-Qaeda suspect was in Canada seeking nuclear material to create a dirty bomb, a conventional explosive device rigged with radioactive material that could contaminate a large area for years. The question remains, if its key leadership has been neutralized, what explains Al-Qaeda's continuing viability? Well, the answer most likely lies in the organization's franchise-like structure, which absorbs sympathizers and allows it to carry on without direct supervision from above. In a 1999 interview with PBS's Frontline, the Saudi dissident Dr. Saeed Al-Faghi noted that Osama bin Laden's group includes both a core group of acolytes and a looser group of sympathizers that number in the thousands. Since America's effective attack on al-Qaeda's top leadership, intelligence analysts believe the group's surviving leaders have franchised their style of violence to terrorist groups around the world, creating a new challenge for counterterrorism officials. It's been estimated that some 20,000 people from 47 countries were trained in the group's Afghanistan training camps. Today, those graduates, united by that shared training experience, have fanned out across the world to lead smaller, like-minded terrorist groups, which have proved harder to track and defend against. Some of these terrorists are in sleeper cells in the United States and Canada, poised and waiting to strike. No matter how many direct followers he actually has, Osama bin Laden remains effectively the leader of an untold number of committed fanatics in the U.S. and around the world, each of them committed to our violent destruction. Only time and unceasing vigilance will eradicate their evil influence on the world. Finally, we must look at the Israeli-Palestinian issue. The first principle in any responsible evaluation of the Israeli-Palestinian conflict is this. Israel is not only our closest ally in the Middle East, it is one of our most important allies of all. America and Israel share common values and beliefs. We have an important strategic interest in assisting Israel based on our long partnership. And as one of the historical birthplaces of Western civilization, the state of Israel deserves every protection we can offer. Today, perhaps more than ever, Israel is fighting for its life. With the Arab world primed to move against it, Israel needs our support. And I firmly believe that we must allow its Prime Minister, Ariel Sharon, to do what is necessary to protect his citizens. It would be deeply wrong for us to adopt one standard for our own efforts in fighting terrorism and to judge Israel by another. Whether practiced by Republican or Democratic presidents, however, American policy in recent years has turned on the mistaken contention that Israel must continue to cede precious land to the Palestinians in exchange for promises of peace. And yet, as we have seen with so many other corrupt regimes, the Palestinians continue to break their promises. Since the Oslo Accords of 1993 and before, the Palestinians have broken their promises often enough that it seems certain they had no intention of honoring them in the first place. This duplicity can be directly placed at the doorstep of the Palestinian Authority, including Yasser Arafat, a group that is committed to destroying Israel and not coexisting with it. Through the history of this conflict, Israel's attempts to appease the Palestinians have resulted in more violence, not less. Indeed, the current round of violence can be traced directly back to an Israel peace offer. In July 2000, Israeli Prime Minister Ehud Barak met with Yasser Arafat, the Palestinian leader, at Camp David. Despite intense political pressure from home, Barak practically begged Arafat to accept a Palestinian state. Yet, as the Washington Post reported, Arafat turned down the most extraordinary concessions. Arafat walked away from the offer of a lifetime and returned home to declare a new intifada, or uprising, a few months later. More than 6,700 Israeli casualties have followed, including nearly 900 deaths. This latest cycle of violence has seen the emergence of a grotesque new wrinkle. Palestinian children being recruited to become suicide bombers to kill Israeli civilians. Arafat has condoned and encouraged this chilling development. Despite every effort to approach him as an honest broker, Arafat has repeatedly proven a corrupt and bloodthirsty terrorist whose only goal is the total destruction of Israel. His ability to walk away from Barak's offer of peace should have convinced the world that he will never be serious about peace with Israel. And his will to continue the intifada against Israel, unfortunately, is matched by more than adequate means. According to Aaron Zievi, Israel's chief of military intelligence, as of last year, Arafat had a net worth of $1.3 billion. If that sum seems incredible, consider that the European Union alone has sent Arafat and the Palestinian Authority an average of $150 million every year for the past decade. Also, the Arab League has donated $1 billion since 2000. Arafat continues to fund the violence directly. An ally at a meeting of Palestinian leaders once asked, "Well, where is the money for the Intifada?" The Weekly Standard recently reported, "Well, here I am," replied Arafat. Arafat's resources will allow him to maintain his war against Israel for the foreseeable future. Since the Yom Kippur War, many Arab dictators have tried to claim the mantle of leadership of the greater Arab world by fomenting hatred and violence against Israel. Libya's Muammar Gaddafi and Iraq's Saddam Hussein are recent examples. A large-scale Middle East war would throw the world economy into a tailspin, propelled by skyrocketing oil prices and investor fears. But if the United States continues to restrain Israel's ability to defend itself effectively against many of the same terrorist forces that threaten America, the real risk, to my mind, is that Israel itself could fall. And if that should happen, the result would be not only a major strategic loss, but a knife close to the heart of Western civilization. Many of the forces aligned against Israel are the very same ones that seek America's annihilation. Israel must survive, and the United States must ensure its survival. The best avenue toward minimizing direct U.S. involvement to defend Israel is for the U.S. to lift the restraints on Israel, let her defend herself, and openly embrace her as an ally in the war on terror. During the Cold War, Ronald Reagan invoked John Winthrop's vision of America as a shining city upon a hill, a beacon of hope to freedom-loving people everywhere. Today, as George W. Bush has alerted us, freedom and fear are once again at war. These early days of the conflict have seen seasons of outstanding victory, the routing of the Taliban, the fall of Saddam, the days of lasting loss. But Americans have proven strong, and the world must recognize that we will prevail. Still, we cannot prevail tomorrow without courageous leadership today. Our leaders will choose how we meet the challenges of the future, with strength and conviction, or with cowardice and accommodation. We, in turn, will choose those leaders. In doing so, we must remember we are choosing our future. And in 2004, and the many years to come, I trust America will make the right choice.
We hope you've enjoyed this program from Harper Audio. Thank you.
Audible hopes you have enjoyed this program.